Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you very much for inviting me on today, Bob.
Well, it's I've been thinking about you for quite a while, and it just came to me the other, well, about a month ago. I thought I'm going to have him back on the show because of his other book coming out.
Yes, and actually that title, The Overthrown Boat, was really the working title for the book that became The Mystery of Scarbrae.
Ah, all right. You know, for some of the listeners in the UK, what I know some people know about, can you just give a brief history about yourself?
Yes, I'm by profession a software designer, and in the middle 1990s, I stumbled across an article about an African tribe called the Dogon. And the Dogon are a modern-day primitive tribe whose culture serves as a kind of crossroads for various ancient traditions. They do certain things like Judaism, certain things like ancient Egypt, and certain things like Buddhism. And so it occurred to me that they would make a very good starting point for a comparative study of religion and ancient creation traditions between cultures to try to scope out what things are similar and what things are different from culture to culture. And so that led to me accidentally writing a book. I was just keeping notes for myself and eventually self-published a book from those notes. And then that book was picked up by a publishing company. And since then, I've been writing about Africa and Egypt and India and Tibet and China and ancient Turkey. And the latest book is about northern Scotland. The book beyond that will be about the Maori in New Zealand. So I'm sort of working my way around the world here, trying to trace this ancient system of symbols and language from culture to culture.
Ah, it sounds very interesting. You know, the mystery of the Scarabre at 3,200 BC, what is interpreted to have been the first true farming village in northern Scotland appeared on Orkney Island.
That's right. There had been family farms on Orkney Island since around 4,000 BC. But suddenly, around 3,200 BC, they find a cluster of eight houses, or eight chambers, in one location at Scarbrae along the beach of Orkney Island, where they believe families, several different families, got together and were working agricultural fields. But in their spare time, they were raising megalithic monuments, a series of them, that were connected by a road in ancient times that no one is quite sure what these monuments were about, and they're not even sure who the people were who created them. But they were produced over several generations, so there must have been a master plan that passed from, you know, grandparent to parent to child over a series of generations.
Right. Is it not clear who the people were and who lived here or where they may have originated from?
That's right. And the evidence is fairly sparse. The pottery, the style of pottery that's created there doesn't connect to local styles of pottery in Scandinavia or in the region. The languages they're speaking on the island at that time don't connect. Names of places don't connect. The architecture doesn't connect. So about 2 years ago, I had an email from a friend in Australia who wanted to know if I thought there might be ancient Egyptian influences in northern Scotland that might have represented where these people came from. And I knew very little about it, but I began to research it because I knew that the African tribe that I study, the Dogon, they seem to have been Egyptian at 3,200 BC.
Right.
So I thought since they do a very good job, they have done a very good job of preserving all of their ancient traditions, that I might be able to see connections between northern Scotland and the Dogon if there actually had been influences. So I did some research and discovered that outwardly there are some resemblances. Scarabre, if you look at it from an aerial view, gives the impression of a typical Dogon village. They are stylistically similar to one another. And there are certain styles of buildings that were created at Scarabre that resemble Dogon structures. Both Scarabray and typical Dogon village are understood to have been very peaceful places. And one of the ways the Dogon maintain the peace is through a particular structure they build called a discussion house. It's called a toguna, and it's the stone ones can be round, similar to one of the structures at Scarabray. And the rule is that if a dispute arises among two or more people, they're required to go to this discussion house, and they can't leave until they've resolved it. So it looked to me like maybe there could be a connection there between those structures. But then as I moved on from that, I discovered that all of the original houses at Scarabray had been designed to a specific plan, an architectural plan, and it was an unusual plan. But the researchers there say that these houses include what they call a unique feature. It's a round room at one end that they refer to as a beehive-shaped room. They don't know what it was for. Mm. So the structure begins with that round room at one end, and which connects to a sort of a square central main room with two side rooms that are rectangular and a bottom room that's rectangular that serves as an entryway. And I did some study and discovered that when the Dogon builds houses from stone, they build them to that same plan, including the round room. But for the Dogon, there's cosmological meaning associated with the plan. The plan isn't just a random plan. It represents something. To the Dogon, it represents the body of a sleeping goddess, and the round room is her head, and the side rectangular rooms are her arms. The square main room is her body cavity, and at Scarabray there's actually a hearth in the center of that main room, which represents a heart, and then the entryway represents her sexual parts. So the Dogon have the same plan for their structures, only without the hearth. And I thought that was very interesting, that from my perspective, when this plan was implemented at Scarabray, they added a hearth in the center, but they added it in keeping with the symbolism of the cosmology.
Right.
I thought, how interesting that they thought to do that.
It was only later on that
I realized that I had it backwards, that it wasn't that the Scarabray plan added the hearth, it's that the Dogon plan removed it, because the Dogon moved to a locality that was very warm. They didn't need a hearth in their house.
Right. And do you think the Egyptians came over here or not, or did they go over there originally?
Well, at 3200 BC, that is, for ancient Egypt, that's very early date. It's before dynastic Egypt. And so there really are no credible researchers who believe that the Egyptians, during pre-dynastic times, before they'd even unified Egypt as a country, that they could have mounted a mission as far away as Scotland. But clearly, whoever was at Scarabray was very capable, because they were building these megalithic stone structures. So the evidence that I have been pursuing, including this house evidence, all seems to suggest that the influence wasn't from Egypt to Scotland, it was from Scotland to Egypt. That now, knowing that these house plans relate to a particular symbolic system, that same symbolic system describes how matter forms and how creation happens. And it describes creation in a particular series of steps. And when you look at the megalithic structures at Scarabray on Orkney Island, thinking about that cosmology, you realize that they represent the correct sequence of stages of creation as the Dogon say they happen. So whoever these farmers were, they had built life-size on Orkney Island, connected by a road, an example of the stages of creation that was on a human scale. You could walk through it from one end to the other. It's as if it were an instructional site, like being able to walk through a museum. If you've ever been to a museum where they had an exhibit of a whale that you could walk through the inside of the whale,
yes,
or things like that, that seems to be what Orkney Island represented based on the structures.
Yeah. Names of many geographic sites in Orkney Islands have no obvious cognates in Scandinavian language. However, the means of these sites' names become sensible when they compare with Dogon and Egyptian roots.
Yes, that's an interesting thing also, is that now having the house plan point us to a particular culture to connect the Scarabray site to, then we also have the possibility that we can connect the languages. Now, on Orkney Island in ancient times, there were two ancient languages that might have been possibilities there. One is called Norn, which is based largely on Norwegian. And there's a second language called Faroese. And it's this Faroese language where we find ongoing connections to Dogon words and to ancient Egyptian words. And so when we go to, in northern Scotland, we go to one of these sites located on a ness. From the Scottish perspective, a ness is a piece of land that extends out into the water. It represents the concept of a nose. But from the Egyptian perspective, a ness represented a tongue. And the Egyptian word referred to the tongue of water that surrounds that little piece of land. And so the same word ness could be used to describe all the same locales from the Egyptian perspective, only it meant a different thing.
Right.
There's a major site on Orkney Island called the Standing Stones of Stennis. This is the remnants of a stone circle. Now, I know, based on the studies I've done, that one of the purposes of these stone circles was to provide a visual calendar based on shadows of the sun. You could track the seasons of the year, and farmers would use it to figure out when to plant their crops and when to harvest their crops. Well, the Egyptian word sten means to distinguish between winter and summer. And so the name Stennis, where this circle exists, looks like it was named for the function of the circle. But we wouldn't know that if we didn't do the comparison to the Egyptian word.
Exactly. You know, like many years ago, they used to do it by the sun to say what time it is, or exactly they were doing the same thing we're doing now.
That's right. And so the stone circle basically gave them a sundial, a kind of a sundial to use. But more importantly than that, if you marked certain shadows and you had stones to mark where those shadows should pass, you could predict when the equinox was going to happen and when the solstice was going to happen, and that was a prerequisite to being able to be farmers.
When do you think the site disappeared completely from habitation?
It was in use from around 3200 BC until around 2600 BC, so for a period of around 600 years. Now, no one is, again, certain why the site was abandoned at 2600 BC, but there were some symbolic messages that were left by the people who lived there to help us understand why they left. Before they left, there was a major feast held at a place called Brodgar, and they can see that at least 400 animals were slaughtered for this major feast. You can imagine that farmers who had been keeping domesticated animals didn't want to leave them behind and to starve to death, and so they had this feast as a way of killing the animals and not leaving them behind to starve. So, but when they finished the feast, they buried over the site, but before they buried the site over, they carefully placed bones all around the site, but not every bone, just a particular bone. They only placed the shin bones of the animals. And all the other bones, I'm not sure how they disposed of them, but they weren't buried there. Well, this is a method that the Egyptians and the Dogons in ancient times used to try to convey things before there was written language. The Egyptian word for shin bone is a homonym for a word. It's pronounced like a word that means to leave under duress, to leave under bad circumstances. And so these bones are saying, folks, the reason we left this place is because we had to leave here. We didn't have a choice.
Right. Yeah, it must have been hard in them days to live, to survive. And you know, it would be hard you know, I know the sites are placed around a body of water, roughly in the form of a spiral. One Egyptian word for the spiral is Sekhet or Sekhet. The same term can also mean reed.
That's right. And so as we talk about these Dogon stages of creation that happen in a particular sequence, you can think of them sort of as geometry. There's a site called the Watchstone of Stennis that represents a geometric point. It's a single point. By the time you get to the standing stones of Stennis, you've created a circle. You move on to the burial mound there called Maes Hau, and you have a three-dimensional hemisphere. And when you get to when the road eventually leads you around the spiral of and around the waterways there to Scarabrae on the ocean, Scarabrae represents a cluster of eight chambers, which is, from a scientific perspective, this is a correlate to something called the Calabi-Yau space in string theory. This is a structure that's thought to exist at every point in space and time. So that series of shapes in the Dogon system goes a few additional steps beyond that. It actually continues on upward till you get to, conceptually upward till you get to atoms. But the next stage beyond that cluster is represented by an agricultural field for the Dogon. And we know that there was, it was an agricultural field next to Scarabrae where they were, where the farmers were cultivating crops. From the Dogon perspective, what they're trying to represent symbolically is something called fundamental particles, which for a scientist, these particles form against what's called a background field, and the agricultural field represents that field. But it's represented on two levels at the same time. It's a mythical concept, but it's also an actual physical field that the Dogon plow and cultivate and plant, you know, they plant plants and grow them and harvest them. It's an actual real-world place. The Dogon refer to it as the field of the Aru priest. So as I was working on my book, realizing that in the time period we're talking about, the Dogon were probably Egyptian, I wondered if the Egyptian had a similar concept of this field of the Aru priest. And so I discovered they did. Their name for field is the same name as the name for that spiral. It's pronounced Sekhet. And the concept was Sekhet Aru, which in Egypt is translated as field of reeds. In ancient Egypt, the field of reeds was their concept of a heaven. But just like the Dogon mythological concept here, it worked on two levels. It was this imaginary mythical place where people would go after they die, but it was also depicted in art as an actual physical field that the pharaoh, when he died after his spirit went to heaven, would be expected to work in the agricultural field. Later on, that same concept passed down to the ancient Greeks as the Elysian fields. And the Greeks also treated it on two levels, as a mythical storyline, but also as an actual geographic place. And the Greek poets and authors used to write about the Elysian fields and describe where it was and what it looked like and what attributes it had. And all of these descriptions are Orkney Island. They talk about specifically a white island on the far edge of the Western Ocean. Orkney Island is characterized by brilliant white beaches. They describe it as being a place of great winds, and Orkney Island is a place of great winds. That's one of its characteristics. The Egyptians have artworks that show animals in the Sekhet Aru, and these animals are all animals that we find are indigenous to Orkney Island. They're ibises, and they're a particular style of cattle with long horns. And we they're pretty much any animal that we see depicted in the Egyptian artwork is also indigenous to Orkney Island. The Greeks even referred to it as Okeanos. There's a Greek poet named Pindar who referred to the island as Okeanos. So there are lots of reasons to think that there were connections here that the Greeks were aware of to specifically to Orkney Island, and that this concept was shared by the Egyptians.
Very interesting. What do you think, why did they go and live there when it must have been cold, it must have been bitter up there, it must have been really cold, and how do you think they could survive up there?
Well, at the time, at 3200 BC, the climate in Orkney Island had suddenly warmed. This is sort of a trend. There are several indications of several instructional sites in different eras of time since about 10,000 BC, and in each one of those, the geologists say that the climatologists say that the climate had just warmed up in that place immediately before we see the evidence of this instructional site appearing. Now, what's even more interesting at Orkney Island is that 100 years after the site appears, we suddenly find all around the world the appearance of agriculturally based kingships, four of them appearing all at the same moment at 3100 BC, one in Egypt, whose name was Taru, one in Ireland called Aru, one in China called Eru, and one in South America called Peru. And those terms, those prefixes, have specific meanings in the Egyptian language. From one perspective, they represent names for the four cardinal points, north, south, east, and west. And from another perspective, they represent four progressive stages of agriculture. They represent an unplowed field, a plowed field, a planted field. The third step is a field with growing, adult plants in it. And the fourth stage is a granary where the harvested plants are kept. So we have two different sort of sets of confirmation for those terms. And each of these sites was associated, each of these kingships was associated with the image of a lion, or in South America, the closest thing they had to a traditional lion that we think of in Egypt, a large puma or a large cat. So we have symbolism that way associated with these kingships that is a match also. And so against the backdrop that nobody can really explain why, at four far-ranging sites around the world, these kingships all appear at the same moment, all based on agriculture. There have been studies done. There's a scholar I was reading who had done a long study to try to identify what qualities does a culture have to have in order to support one of those early agricultural kingships. And he decided, after cross-checking all the criteria, that the only requirement is that they know about agriculture.
Right. Excuse me a minute. A drink. The Dogon concept works on two levels. Is the actual physical field that is planted and cultivated, but it also presents a mythical concept.
Right, and that that mythical concept is all part of this this creation plan. According to groups like the Dogon and the Buddhists, humanity received deliberate instruction in civilizing skills. You can see this in the region of the Fertile Crescent, where all within a very small region, back around 10,000 BC, you have all sorts of things appear for the first time. You have cultivated grains for the first time. You have megalithic stonework for the first time. You have the creation of working with metals, metallurgy. You have domestication of animals and animal husbandry of, keeping cows and sheep and pigs.
Yeah.
All of these things originated in that one region in a very short amount of time, and then sort of you can see the spread of it from there, and it follows the spread of DNA in all different directions, and it follows the spread of religion in those directions, and it follows the spread of language in those directions. And so you can see how this happened. In Egypt, there is no firm theory as to where the first Egyptian pharaohs came from around 3100 BC. Dynastic Egypt appears sort of against the backdrop of nothing. They're not sure what ethnicity the pharaohs originally were. So it looks to me as if they had been deliberately trained to do the thing that they were doing.
Yeah. You know, when you first start out and you say you pick Scarlet Brain, or how do you go on about finding that information from the beginning? You know, when you're writing your book, you must have to do lots and lots of research.
You do, but I had sort of done a lot of it as preparation for this ahead of time, because I had studied so many different cultures that have the same system of symbols. I mean, the symbols we're talking about are the ones that Carl Jung called archetypes, and they appear everywhere. And there's a mystery about the archetypes, about why are these so similar? Why are these symbols so similar from culture to culture? Sometimes cultures that are all the way across the world from each other have the same symbols and the same meanings. And so one explanation for that, possible explanation, is the reason they all had the same symbols is because they all had the same teachers. You go to South America,
right,
or you go to China, or you go places like that, and these cultures have a tradition that in ancient times there's a group of knowledgeable ancestors who deliberately came and instructed them in civilizing skills. How to weave a cloth, or how to plow a field, or how to make pottery.
So basically, the symbols are the same everywhere you go around the world. They all was the same thing, well, meant the same thing about cooking, planting seeds, seasons, tell you about the different seasons, when to plant, not to plant. I know you said the warmer weather had come, but I'm sure you must have lots of rain as well.
Yes, I'm sure they did even then, because I know I grew up on the west coast of the United States, where the climate is very similar to what it is in the British Isles. And I know that we saw a lot of rain every year on the west coast. That's just the way the prevailing weather patterns work. But to come up with the information is sometimes very interesting, because at 3200 BC, you're before any written language, any written texts. And part of what I have to do to be sure that I'm on the right track is I have to find ways to firmly anchor a reference in something that I know is real. It's not just something I imagined. And one of the ways I do that is through cross-comparison to various cultures. That house plan at Scarabray does a couple of things for me. It pointed me to the right culture to compare to, and then it offered me all sorts of direct comparisons, language and architecture and cosmology and all these other things that tie together. And when it ties together that well, you know you're on the right track.
Yeah, the same concept survived among the ancient Greeks in similar form as the Elysian fields described alternatively as a mythical heaven, but also described geographically as if it was an actual physical locale.
Yes, the term Elysian fields, okay, the way that words are put together in this ancient system is that the system was developed before written language, and so each phonetic value carried a meaning. Now, there was a naming convention for tribes back in the ancient times where the tribe would be named for the stage of creation that they particularly emphasized. It's like each tribe had a major, like a student would have in college or university. And so El was the name of a deity associated with the Hebrew god Yah. And there's a bay on the Orkney Island called Ske'el, which the word Ske means to celebrate. So the name of the bay says celebrates El. And that same El, I believe, is what is connected to the term Elysian. And what's attached, the second half of Elysian, is a word for island. So essentially, Elysian field says the El Island fields, the island of El fields.
All right. excuse me. Go on, you carry on.
These names of deities help us to sort things out a little bit. Also, the reason that I had called my the working title of my original book was called "The Overthrown Boat." The reason is because there are processes that occur during the formation of matter that involve rotation. That's one of the key motions that they're trying to help us understand what it is. And the way that they conveyed that idea was with the image of a boat that capsizes. If you think of a boat turning over, that's the rotational motion they were talking about. Well, the term scarab ray, the word scara comes from that same root I was talking about, sake, that means to celebrate, but it actually means overturned or overthrown. And the second word, bray, is an Egyptian word, bari, that means boat. And so when I began writing the book, I thought I would write name the book for the place, but I ended up calling it The Overthrown Boat rather than Scarab Ray. I actually like the title my publishers came up for, The Mystery of Scarab Ray, I think is probably a better title for the general public.
Yes. The Egyptians have a similar concept known as Sekhet or Sekhetara, or the field of reeds. On one level, understanding is represented kind of mythical heaven where the soul of pharaohs were good after death. On the other level, the pharaohs were actually working to cultivate the field.
Yes, around the same time that these Scarab Ray was abandoned, around 2600 BC, the Egyptians started writing the names of their pharaohs differently. Originally they had used Egyptian glyphs to write the name of the pharaoh inside of a sort of a squared border. Well, around 2600 BC, that switches, and now they're suddenly using an oval border around the pharaoh's name. And that oval is called a cartouche. And the Egyptian scholars understand that cartouche represents an island. So they're really honoring, and it looks as if they're honoring the concept of this island that their instruction had come from. There are a couple of other ways they also honor those islands. About that same period of time, the first Egyptian priest or pharaoh who started building pyramids was named Seneferu. Well, the Egyptian word and the Dogon word Sene means image of or reflection of, and Feru is a term that ties back to Orkney Island in an interesting way. I'll have to back up to give you some background here. At 10,000 BC, what looked like instructional sanctuaries were housed in high mountaintop places that were so high up it would be hard for us as hunters and gatherers to get up there to interfere with the people who were trying to help us. It was sort of a safe haven. Well, when I saw Orkney Island, when I realized that here is an island that's right out in the middle of everything. The ocean currents come right to it. It has harbors that are easy to dock a boat in. It's right out in the middle of anything. It has no natural protections whatsoever. I thought, so where is the safe haven for the people who are doing the instructing? They need a place to go to where they can be absolutely sure they can be safe from us.
Yes.
It turns out there is a place. It's just across the water to the north and west of Orkney Island. It's a group of islands called the Faroe Islands, F-A-R-O-E. And so the name of this pharaoh in Egypt, Seneferu, implies that he was naming himself in honor of something called pharaoh. And the word pharaoh in Egypt originally referred to a place, not to a person. So as this pharaoh starts building pyramids, one of the mysteries connected to his pyramids is he built something called the Bent Pyramid. This is a pyramid that starts at a particular angle, and about halfway up the pyramid, it changes angles. It gets to it changes and comes to a sharper point than it would ever, actually a more gradual point than it would have if it had continued the original angle. So there's all sorts of debate about why did he change angles in the middle of building this pyramid? Well, if you go to the Faroe Islands, you discover that there are all sorts of pyramid-like peaks in the Faroe Islands, and one of them does that exact same thing. It bends at that same point and creates the exact same shape that Sene Pharaoh created in his pyramid. As a matter of fact, if you look at the four pyramids that he was involved with building, each one of them mimics a shape that we can point to in the Faroe Islands. So it looks as if at the same point in time when the Faroe Islands were being, or when Orkney Island was being abandoned, that this Egyptian pharaoh who was fond of that, in the same way that I'm fond of my college campus, started building structures that reminded him of Orkney Island and the Faroe Islands.
Right. We have gods. Who did they pray to? What gods did they have?
Well, in those days, there's a different concept. In the Dogon system, there isn't really properly any god. There's one mythic character named Amma who rises sort of to the level of what we would consider to be a creator god. But if you compare the Dogon system to the Egyptian system, every place where the Egyptians have a god or a goddess, the Dogon have a concept of creation or a stage of creation. So you've taken a concept and you've basically anthropomorphized it. You've turned it into somebody that looks like a human and is represented as a god. But for the Dogon, they aren't gods. So the same would have been true leading up to that. And as you go back in towards 10,000 BC, there weren't properly gods in the same way that we think of them today. Where we say, pray to a god, they say, celebrate a concept. Where in Christianity we talk about good versus evil, in these early traditions they're talking about truth versus error. It's a very non-judgmental system. It's not the same kind of outlook at all. It's a very egalitarian sort of system. And from what I can see, all the evidence I see from those most ancient times, many of the aspects of later religion that we take for granted were not a part of what they were talking about.
Right. The Greek descriptions of Elysian fields called Okinos by the poet Pindar are a consistent match for the Orkney Islands.
Yes, you remember there was an archaeologist named Schliemann who was convinced that the Greek descriptions of the Trojan War were historical, not mythical, and he started following the trail of the references about the Trojan War and actually was able to uncover the city of Troy as a real locale. In other words, he could show that what looked to us like myth was really historical and geographically correct. Well, the same thing is true here, that we have a series of descriptions talking about the Elysian fields that look like they are geographically correct for Orkney Island. And so what that leads me to believe is, I take from those two examples that when the Greeks talk about geography, they're probably telling us accurate truths. And so from that, my best guess would be that their stories about Atlantis might also have some truth to them.
Right. Well, do you think they did a lot of fishing up there then?
At Orkney Island, there's evidence that they ate fish as part of their regular diet. But it doesn't look like that's what they were primarily doing. What they were primarily doing was agriculture. And they had farm animals also. But we can see that in their spare time, they spent an enormous amount of effort cutting and moving these stones and setting them up over very long periods of time. So it sounds to me like they were very busy with all of that. But living on an island, I would imagine they must have been capable fishermen and they must have been capable boat people. It would be hard to imagine they lived there and could do that.
How did they build the houses? Were they round or domed? Or were they like normal houses or domed houses?
Well, the village as it sits today is right next to the beach. The indication is that back in those days, it was actually set a little farther back from the beach, and that the shoreline has moved a little bit over time. But apparently, they built these houses out of flat stones on a flat surface. As if you look, used flat shale to build a wall by stacking flat stones. But then they bermed them on the outside. There was earth. There were earthen mounds and mounds. Created out of sort of the everyday refuse they had, they would deposit it outside the walls to help insulate. And so now, if you go to the site and you look at it, it looks as if they're set down in the ground, but in fact they were built above ground originally, and then these hillsides were sort of built up around them. They're very capably built houses. Some of them include little stone dressers and stone beds, and the houses are interconnected with one another. There are passageways between the houses inside low walls, and it's a very interesting sight.
Like a little village.
Like a little village. Like the it's considered to be the first true farming village, but to only house 8 families. Now, in the mythic traditions of all these other cultures I've studied, they specifically say that 8 tribespeople were sequestered at a remote location and instructed and sent back to teach everybody else. So the number 8 has some significance from that standpoint. It also has significance scientifically because the structure that I say that it represents at every point in space and time represents a set of collapsed dimensions, and the number that's given for that is very often 8.
8. Because of the 8 chambers.
8 chambers, that's right.
Right. I was going to ask you something about when they found all this material, did they find any coins, or did they find any tokens, or did they find any things they could eat with, and bowls and things like that?
They found household type things. They found pottery that they know things were, the food was kept in and so forth. They found some interesting geometrically carved stone balls that no one is quite sure what they were used for, but I have an idea what they might have been used for. My wife and I were in Portland, Oregon a few years ago during the summer, and there was an artist there who created very similar kinds of geometric balls that he was using to make patterns in sand with, artistic patterns. And it occurred to me that in Dogon culture, farming was a family process. Everyone in the family was involved in some way. And that if you only had 8 families, you were going to need help when it came to harvesting and trying to thresh the grain and things like that. That if you created these balls that your children could use to play in every day in the sand to make interesting patterns, then when the harvest time came, instead of having them play with them in the sand, they could play with them in the harvested crop. And as they rolled these balls around, they were threshing the grain.
Right. When people died, did they bury them one-to-one, or did they bury them on top of each other? And how do you think they buried them?
It's interesting that they really have not come across the number of graves that they had expected to come across at the site, and they're surmising that they were buried in mass graves, and the reason they haven't found any is because they just haven't stumbled on those mass graves yet. But that's a mystery. What they have significantly not found there is anything that connects to an armament or a weapon, or anything that connects to a fortification. So they know it was a peaceful place. They have pottery. They have everyday items. They have a very small number of little sort of engravings or what might be inscriptions, but nobody can translate them particularly. There's not a lot of evidence there to go by as to who it was that was there. And so I enter a situation where there really is no official theory to compete against, that By chance, I'm the first person who has found a link to another culture that seems to play out in a predictive way with what they find there.
What do you think some of them had moved from there and gone elsewhere?
Yes, at 2600 BC, it looks like they moved down into Scotland and Ireland, and that by Christian times, they were forced out of Ireland. The earliest Scandinavian references to Orkney Island mention finding two groups living side by side on the island. One was a group of pygmies of very strange habits who they considered to be sorcerers, and the second was a group of average-sized clerics who always wore white and who were so different from the Scandinavians as to constitute a separate race rather than a separate profession. These sound like descriptions of the Dogon priests who always wear white and their mythical teachers called Numo. The Egyptian word for pygmy is Nema.
Ah.
So I'm imagining that those early reports stumbled, you know, those early report people who were reporting stumbled on the Dogon and their mythic teachers on site.
When did they first find the Scarabrae?
It was covered over at 2600 BC. Some people think it was deliberately covered over. And for 4,000 years, it remained covered over. No one knew it was there. Until the middle of the 1800s, around 1850, there were a series of storms that hit the island, and a portion of the village was uncovered by those storms. And the fellow who owned the land that it was on, a person by the name of the Laird of Scale, invested the next 8 years of his life and a large part of his personal fortune excavating and preserving and trying to understand the site.
Isn't that strange? Call it the Laird.
Yes. That's less strange than it seems. As time has gone on with my books, important terms in these ancient cultures seem to play out in things that connect to me.
Yes,
there's that little egg of the world,
like
that little cluster of...
It was meant to be for you to write the book about it.
Yes, the first thing a person discovers or learns in when they're in this field of study is that there are very odd things happening that we sometimes can't explain.
Yes, I can understand that as well. And I'd like to go on, I'd like to ask you about your last book, what you was on about, the overthrown boat.
The overthrown boat refers to the same book. The previous book that I had published was called Point of Origin. And
yes,
it talks about a similar kind of instructional site, only much, much older, back at 10,000 BC, that was high on a mountaintop in Turkey called Göbekli Tepe.
Oh, yes. That sounds so interesting, that does. And I think I've got some on that as well, somewhere on the line. And what was all that about then?
Well, the purpose of that book was to find a way, just as I've tried at Scarabrae, to find a way to link the evidence we see there to a particular culture. I was trying to do the same thing for Göbekli Tepe. There were also all kinds of symbolic things at Göbekli Tepe that seem to relate to the later cultures, you know, 7,000 years later at 3,000 BC. The animals that we see pictured on the pillars at Göbekli Tepe are the same animals that are important to pharaohs and to kings in China, and same animals that are used as icons for goddesses and gods. And I thought there's something common here between these two sites. So I was looking for a way to connect forward from this 10,000 BC era site to the later cultures. And again, the connection is made through a very kind of fortuitous find. It's really language that makes the connection. there are ancient Egyptian names for what look like mountaintop sanctuaries, similar to Göbekli Tepe. In particular, a name that was applied to the region that Göbekli Tepe is found in. And those names provided the clues to link forward to a matriarchal group called the Shakti cult, who have all the same iconic elements that you see at Göbekli Tepe, and they were the foundation for the traditions in India, the Vedic tradition and the Buddhist tradition and the Hindu tradition. And you can see evidence that around 4000 BC, that tradition may have come into Egypt in the south down by an island called Elephantine. And so that book uses language and references from the Shakti cult to try to demonstrate how do we get from 10,000 BC to all these other modern, more modern traditions at 3,000 BC.
Lovely. Well, we've got about 3.5 minutes left. Right, can you let everybody know where they can get in touch with you, Led?
Okay, the easiest place to find me actually is on Facebook. My name is Laird Scranton. That's LairdScranton. And I have a regular individual Facebook page. There is a LairdScranton.com website, but it's a fan site. It's not really my site. The contact tab from that site does reach me, though. I'll receive an email if somebody sends it. My books you can pretty much find anywhere. My publisher is Inner Traditions, so there's a site called innertraditions.com, and I have an author page with Simon & Schuster, which is part of that same book group. And my books can be found in bookstores pretty much anywhere. Barnes & Noble often carries them in stock. They can be ordered pretty much anywhere.
Right. And The Mystery of Scarabrea will be out in November.
It's scheduled for the end of November. I wouldn't be surprised if it ends up being December instead of November, but it's in process. And then beyond that, there are already two other manuscripts ready to go. The next one talks about where these mythical teachers from Scarabrea ended up thousands of years later. And a book beyond that talks about some very foundational concepts of how creation happens and how that relates to these religions.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Led.
Well, thank you very much again for having me.
It's always a pleasure when you're on here talking about Scarabrea, and hopefully when your next book comes out, hopefully I'll have you on before then, but you never know. But it'd be nice for when your book comes out to have you on the show.
Now, for people who are in the British Isles, I will be presenting at a conference at Marlborough College in England on August 20th. It's called the Megalithic Odyssey Conference, and there'll be a group of half a dozen speakers that include people like Robert Bovall and James Swagger, and quite a nice group of presenters who are going to be there. So I'm looking forward to...
And what day is it, over a weekend?
This is over a weekend. August 20th, I think, is a Saturday. And then the next day, I think they're taking a group to Avebury.
Oh, yes, yes. They always like to go to Avebury. Yes, I'm sure it'll be a fantastic weekend. You never know, I might get myself down there and meet up with you.
Oh, that would be terrific. I would love to meet you in person.
Yes. Well, thank you again. You have a lovely weekend.
Well, thank you. You too. And I hope that surgery comes about properly.
Yes, I do as well, Led. I do as well. And I'll be walking. I'll be trotting by then.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Good night and God bless.
Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye-bye.